Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood. Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC, member SIPC, a registered broker-dealer.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Delivering on the returns, increasing our margins.
Ratings go down the toilet if I'm not here.
All I do is simply put the math in my favor.
We agree that Brandon and John do good work.
The reason is simple wrestling economics.
Told the Netflix numbers. I've been told the metrics a little bit, probably five different times. I still don't get it.
There were respectable wrestling journalists who needed answers.
Thank you very much, members of the media. I hope you all go to hell.
How about we pop a number right here, right now?
A whole part of the show, man.
Welcome, everybody, to the official Pollock and Thurston NFL Week 2 coverage. I am John Pollock. I am not joined by Josh Allen. Instead, it is Brandon Thurston.
You're joined by Matt Prater today, the hero of Buffalo, New York.
If my life depended on it, I could not have identified that person at all.
That's the kicker who's been with the team for a few days now, and he won the game for along with Travis Henry. He won the game for the Bills on Sunday night.
1-0. Your Buffalo Bills undefeated, tied for first across the entire league.
Yes.
Congratulations.
They were in first place actually before the game even began because everybody else in the division had lost at that point.
As far removed as I am from the NFL, I am currently watching the Netflix doc on the Dallas Cowboys. Now, I don't know what got me into this, but this thing is 8 episodes long. It's like an hour an episode. And it's pretty damn great. If you are a fan, I actually was a Dallas Cowboys fan as a child when I did at least somewhat follow the NFL.
Wow,
largely grew out of any kind of football.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad you've distanced yourself from that.
But I'm telling you missed your calling being in Dallas in 1996 to cover the Michael Irvin outside off the field exploits involving prostitutes, cocaine. Nope. Yes. And then
wasn't the whole offensive line involved in nefarious activities?
Let's just say that Michael Irvin was a big fan of the offensive line, the defensive line, all kind of lines. Michael Irvin was putting up his nose.
Now, did Jerry Jones remind you of anyone?
It's impossible. It's absolutely impossible to disentangle Jerry Jones from his pal that may or may not have been a very aggressive driver. Very, very similar.
They both like to draw big crowds at AT&T Stadium. Mm-hmm.
They do. They do. Both. I'm sure you could draw a lot of parallels between Jerry Jones and one Vincent Kennedy McMahon, but it's a very, very well done documentary series. I've enjoyed it so far. So that is my football recommendation for the week. We are going to be talking about many, many topics today. Actually, that's a lie, okay? When Brandon and I were putting our topics together on Tuesday night, I was like, there's definitely some stuff to talk about. This is not a crazy week of news. So if anyone does have questions to throw along the way, feel free to send us a super chat. We are going to be discussing the latest in the Bubba the Love Sponge versus Nick Bollea lawsuit that is currently ongoing, and if you're watching on video, that expression by Brandon sums up his
thoughts. I told you off air, I hate this lawsuit.
And I love it. I think it's fantastic. I think that it is going to be a wonderful case to continue to follow. Complete now with, we are just 2 days away from the release of this documentary, Video Killed the Radio Star, that was screened last Friday in Tampa, Florida. So we will talk about that a little later on. Bryan Danielson, the unofficial official ambassador of AEW, now also full-time commentator for AEW beginning tonight as well, and probably should be the man that's on PR duty for every single pay-per-view.
The Lance Russell of AEW now, yes?
Or
is that Tony Schiavone?
I will give that distinction. He can be Lance Russell. He can be Dave Brown. I would love Bryan Danielson to, you know, he could do part-time commentary, part-time weatherman for TBS, yeah. TNT. And it was a stormy week last week as we look at the weather alerts towards television ratings, but then we got a big rebound with SmackDown on Friday night and even Collision getting a big bump on Saturday night, and that is where we start. Where Friday night, the returning AJ Lee came to Chicago in front of 16,642 fans in Chicago, a mere 100 people off the mark that was cited on the SmackDown broadcast. So the connection of WrestleTix to Michael Cole, ever so close. You could barely slide a paper between the differentiation.
Yes, and it was a good rating, too, and especially in the demo. Total viewership was the highest they'd had in a number of weeks, but it's coming off, you know, some record lows in the last month or two. But especially the demo, this 0.51 demo, which is the highest going back to what, April 25th, so just after WrestleMania.
Also a show in Chicago, by the way.
Was it now? And this, we don't have quarter hours, but this clip, two of the clips, in fact, I think, for SmackDown involving AJ Lee did well over 1 million. I think the one did 2 million, the other one did 5 million, which is really high for WWE.
I think the YouTube clip is at over, I mean, I checked yesterday, I think it was over 3.5 million. And this is, you know, we're talking just a couple of days in terms of what that generated. You can look at, you know, the fact they did kind of, they didn't really promote this until the day of. It was Cena's last ever appearance on SmackDown. But I mean, this to me was the AJ Lee factor. And I think it is.
And I was expecting it for some time. Were you?
Well, it's a topic I wanted to bring to you because this was one where, like, so often we see it goes for WWE and AEW, and generally it's across the board, this obsession with surprises and keeping stuff under such lock and key, this power that we have over the surprise. And this was a instance that has proven very reliable in the past where you don't have to necessarily just flat out state this person is showing up on this date at this time, but you insinuate it in such a way that you know what you're getting. And like, had this been this state secret by WWE and nobody would have had any clue AJ Lee was showing up here, like, do you have this level of response to a show? And I think that there is certainly something to be said for, at times, surprising your audience, but then another is just leading them into a direction where anticipation leads to a number like this, that they got a great spike out of it. You got a tremendous, like, quote unquote, surprise pop when she did show up. You reaped all the benefits of a surprise, but you also got an inflated audience as a result of it.
Yeah, it's an open secret with CM Punk and AEW, right? And on probably both occasions when, you know, when he debuted on Rampage, when he returned on Collision, it wouldn't surprise me if AEW and WWE encourage that kind of thing and sort of, you know, make sure that certain information gets out there and that gets people talking. That ensures, in this case, I mean, do you have the rating being elevated to the extent that it was if that had been a really well protected secret?
Against the NFL as well, we should add.
Yes.
Yeah, there was the international game going down on Friday from Brazil that aired on YouTube, which did 17.3 million viewers on YouTube, which was actually below expectations, and 16.2 million in the U.S. for that NFL game. So they were going up against that, and the show was SmackDown, that is, was up 38% in viewership, up 82% from the previous week in 18 to 49, and across the board, all of their female demos, doubled or more than doubled from the previous week. So I look at that as like a real success. And it's not like, you know, SmackDown, they were coming off an all-time low the previous week. So it is worth noting that fact. But they were still second on television the week prior and this week, or on cable. And this week, they beat everything on television.
So in this NFL game they were going against, this is the Brazil game. Is that right?
Yes.
This was
yes.
The Brazil game that was on YouTube. There's some controversy about the measurement of how Nielsen was measuring this viewership on YouTube. Have you seen any of that?
I have seen the debate to where respected media analysts have now started to say, why are we even reporting ratings anymore? They're so flawed.
And respected media executives, including Fox's Michael Mulvihill, who's their analytics VP, I believe, as well as the ESPN analytics VP, both up in arms that the methodology for this measurement, they said it was AMA, average minute audience, but they have not disclosed what their methodology was.
Yeah, it's just putting a bow on SmackDown, because I want to talk about this Nielsen subject. It's very interesting. Also for SmackDown is that, you know, rarely does SmackDown pop up in any kind of significance on the ta-dum charts, which come out each Tuesday, because you only have, first of all, you're taking out the U.S. because of it airing on the USA Network. And it's also only, this is only tabulating data through what, Monday? What's the cutoff for the top 10 charts?
It's Monday through Sunday.
Monday through Sunday. So really, you're talking about the live airing on Friday and then 48 hours of international.
So Raw really has the entire length of time to gather.
Raw is greatly, and when we talk about these charts, it's always the week prior's edition of Raw. So this SmackDown, with the AJ Lee return, it ranked in the top 10 in 18 countries on Netflix and was even higher than last week's Raw in Canada. And I haven't checked all of the charts. I'm sure that was the case in several regions, but like it does. Like, I have never seen SmackDown come anywhere close to that number of top 10 appearances for the episode. So it's just an added metric that they were able to achieve on Friday. Like, this return was a pretty big deal, and I put a lot of that on AJ Lee.
And while we're at it, if you look at the 18 to 49 female demographic for this episode of SmackDown, was a 0.41. And I'm going to start scrolling and see how far I have to go back. I can find one on March 14th that is a 0.50, when they did a 5.2, slightly higher, people 18 to 49. So that is the biggest female demo that they'd had in months too.
So that brings us to the obvious question of, like, the candidacy of AJ Lee for the Observer Hall of Fame.
Best box office draw.
This return is, this is something. Like, if she is, if they maintain
returns and debuts are always really big in this era of wrestling.
Well, since we mentioned it, let's talk about this entire Nielsen uproar. I'm going to have to rely on you to kind of.
I don't know
this.
What it means, but we can raise awareness about it.
Basically, what is Nielsen trying to do here with this new methodology and to account for streaming?
So they put out something on actually September 2nd, where they're announcing that it's going to be sort of a new era of how they measure ratings. It might result in the ratings. Well, what we're seeing, especially like if you look at Programming Insider, which is where we usually get our ratings news from, they're putting preliminary data at the top. And so Nielsen is advising people that if media organizations want to publicize their ratings and, you know, give ratings information out to the media, that they should say that it's, and if they do it the next day, they should say that it's preliminary data, because they're starting to use this Nielsen national TV audience measurement provider for big data plus panel. So I think it's going to take a couple days for the big data plus panel information to get together and get aggregated with everything. They're using some first party information in some cases. It's going to be different. I don't know how different it will be. I know people are probably wondering too, is this why the ratings have been down lately for Dynamite, for the week before for SmackDown? NXT did a slightly below average rating, not last night, but the week before. Collision did an especially low number two collisions ago. I don't necessarily think this has anything to do with it, because I don't think these changes have really gone into effect yet. Although the universe estimates did go into effect, we do know the new universe estimates, which is nobody cares about that. But that's just how you calculate certain ratings numbers, and those shouldn't have a major effect. It's just the population sizes.
Are you ready for the Netflix viewership data to come out for Canelo Crawford after Saturday?
Is that when that is? Saturday?
It is Saturday night at Allegiant Stadium as a...
Will there be multiple durations? Will they manipulate the numbers?
Well, I looked at this card. Dude, this is a long, long card. There are like six undercard fights, and then there's like four or five fights on the main card. This is going to be a really, really long event, is what it looks like at Allegiant Stadium. So,
and the problem, I mean, like Tyson Paul, they're not going to isolate the one fight that everybody's interested in. They're going to measure the entire duration of the main presentation.
Yes, but I think we will get our slew of press releases on Monday, I would assume. More on that boxing card a little later on. But we are going to talk a little bit about Brian Danielson, because this guy was sent to Australia. He did a interview with just about every outlet imaginable. And I want to go
tickets going on sale for their Australia shows this week or something?
Yeah, they're promoting their return in February for the Grand Slam and House Rules that are going on. Interestingly enough, Danielson on one interview stated he found out on Twitter, like everyone else, that he has now been made a full-time commentator on AEW.
Well, that's the best place to get all your news.
That's where you find out about your promotions or new tasks that have been added to your plate. But there's one clip. I will look up the outlet here on this this YouTube show that he was on. It was a very interesting interview that Danielson did, and the host brought up the fact that WWE going head to head with All Out on September the 20th, and what is the thought process that WWE has, and Danielson giving kind of his outline here about what is the strategy as he tries to get into the heads of Nick Khan, Mark Shapiro, and WWE.
AEW existing and being this challenger brand and being as successful as we've been has changed the landscape for wrestling for the wrestlers themselves.
Yeah.
So it's like wrestlers are being paid more now than ever, right? From a sports rights perspective, so for example, most major sports in the United States, the players get anywhere between 40 to 50% of the revenue. And WWE was paying their wrestlers nowhere close to that.
So independent contractors.
Yeah, because as independent contractors. And now keep in mind, they're still not paying anywhere close to that. But they do have to pay more, because if they don't, the talent's going to leave and go to AEW.
Yeah.
AEW does pay that 40 to 50% of their revenue to their wrestlers, despite making much less money. I mean, we still, our TV rights deal was incredible, but we're still the challenger brand, catching up on however many years WWE's had. This is one of the things that, like, people who really crave power and a lot of money play these weird games that I don't understand. Okay, we're going to run all the competitors that might be competitive with us out of this business. Why? It's good. It's good for the wrestlers. It's good for the wrestlers, both in AEW and in WWE. Mm-hmm. It's been good for them. Like, okay, if AEW wouldn't have started, would Cody Rhodes be where he is right now?
Very true.
No, yeah. They have a megastar because AEW exists, right? Mm. Would CM Punk ever have come back? Probably not.
Yeah.
Corporations are not people, right? Mm-hmm. In the United States, I don't know if it's like this in Australia.
Probably the same.
But corporations have been determined as, like, legally as people. They have the same rights as people. And it's just like, wait, what? But they're not people, right? So these corporations make these decisions. But, like, the people in WWE, like, a lot of the people I know are great people, yeah. Right? And so it's like, I'd be interested to know, okay, what's the decision-making process in this? Why, it's not my monkeys, not my circus, whatever the line is for that. You know what I mean? And so like sometimes I think about it and I'm like, oh, and then I think a little bit too much about it. I'm like, oh, not my monkeys, not my circus.
Okay, yes. Yeah.
That was from the Caruso Brothers podcast that did that interview. Very good interview that they did. And the question, Brandon, is Maybe this should be his monkey, and maybe this should be his circus. This guy comes across as like so good in these settings that I think like that is a great role. And sometimes you wonder how this guy ended up in professional wrestling in this industry.
Yeah, we've had those discussions before, particularly about, you know, creative. But I think, yeah, you know, I tried to ask him a couple of years ago too. You know, if he would consider being a permanent executive with AEW after he's done wrestling. So I think you'd be well suited for that, especially if it's not a publicly traded company. But a company that is publicly traded. So I think he's getting to probably what we could emphasize more, which is that why does WWE care? Why are they trying to compete so aggressively with AEW, with their big events, and go head to head with AEW on their pay-per-view events? And I would suggest that the main issue, it's not just like ego and trying to, you know, run companies out of business just so you can say you're number one. I would suggest that the, you know, he's talking about how he wants to get into their heads. And to an extent, I would suggest that their thought process is out in the open. If you look at their TKO's quarterly report for Q1, which was filed back in May, they talk about how direct expenses, this is for WWE in specific too, not just TKO, but for WWE in specific, when they're talking about the profitability, direct expenses increased primarily due to higher talent-related costs compared to the prior year period. And it wasn't just Q1, because if you look at the Q2 report and you do a control F for talent, you'll find in the same portion, the same sentence where it says direct expenses increased primarily due to higher production and higher talent-related costs compared to the prior year. Now, why would they be paying higher talent-related costs compared to the prior year? The price of talent must have, maybe they're just, you know, they're bargaining more aggressively. The talent are, maybe they're bargaining collectively in some secretive way that we haven't learned about yet. Or maybe it's just the fact that, sort of like Danielson is alluding to there or saying, is that there's another company that is well-financed that is bidding aggressively for that talent, and WWE is forced to pay them a lot more. And if you're a publicly traded company, by the way, TKO, publicly traded company, just hit $200 per share. I'll look up what it is right now. It is, it's well back under. It's only $193 right now. But publicly traded company, you want to do great for your shareholders. People's retirement funds are very important. They're in the S&P 500. And, the profitability is the most important thing. So a great way to get costs down would be to run this company out of business so that they don't exist and they're not bidding aggressively for talent, and we can keep talent costs under control.
So why would you help a TNA then, if you're TKO? Why would
is TNA bidding aggressively for talent? I mean, I certainly not to the extent AEW is. I would suggest, I don't know what people are making in TNA. I would suggest it's a lot less than people are making in AEW on, let's say, a median basis.
I guess you look into just the overall strategy here. And, you know, as we've mentioned, like TKO, they've been through this dance with the UFC. And I think they're going to be very careful in terms of how they plot through their strategic maneuvering in the pro wrestling side of things. But like, you could certainly look at this is just like, if you break this down to just suppressing talent costs and you're buying up competitors or working hand in hand with them, like the idea of purchasing a TNA is probably not too far-fetched of an idea at this point in 2025. AEW is like this giant neon sign that prevents you from looking at that aspect as something where this one entity in WWE has such a stranglehold on the industry and is directly operating in such a way to keep talent costs lower. With AEW, I think Bryan Danielson kind of hits the nail on the head there of what the intention is. And it really does go to kind of the concept of like the talent's perspective in this entire thing, that I am sure to a person, not one of them would advocate for the elimination of an AEW, but that's kind of the task at hand here, that is going out and being so competitive against their own leverage, their very fleeting leverage in this industry, and one of which, like, you can kind of remake the entire talent cost structure from the ground up if you don't have a competitor, and how much harder it would be, like if an AEW were to lose its television deal in the next round or something were to happen to an AEW, I think it would be harder than ever to get any kind of competitor. Like the AEW, I think, would be dead on arrival if it tried to launch today, for instance, versus 6 years ago.
It'd be a lot harder. You'd still have a billionaire family that could maybe get meetings with TV networks, but you don't have the exposed weakness that was brought on by years of attrition under the creative leadership of Vince. I think it's part of what you're saying is it's kind of ironic that, you know, in my analysis, this is, you know, this going head to head with AEW pay-per-views is in large part, and doing other things that may be aggressively competitive with AEW is in large part to try to keep talent costs under control, to try to keep AEW from being more successful, ideally to go out of business so that they can't compete for talent. And the people that are, you know, the content that's being, you know, used to do that is the content that involves the talent. You know, like, you're being used on WrestlePalooza if you're a WWE talent. You're being used to be the bulwark that controls your own talent costs. So there's an irony there. And I did some math too as we were working this morning, and to consider, you know, first of all, let's like fact check how much, like what the percentages of the revenue that the talent get. We don't know what the total talent compensation cost is for WWE, but WWE in the trailing 12 months, I did do the math, made $1.6 billion in the trailing 12 months. So like if they were the NFL, you know, $1.6 billion in a half is $800 million. I don't think wrestlers are making $800 million in a year. To say, if you were to divide that across, like, let's say 120 wrestlers, that would make the average wrestler getting something like $6.7 million annually, and that is definitely not happening. So I would suggest it's, you know, something closer to 10% or something like that. Danielson says that AEW wrestlers are getting something closer to 40% of AEW's revenue. Of course, AEW is not a publicly traded company, so we don't know all of their numbers to the extent that we do WWE. But we do have a document which I think I'm dubbing the Harrington Declaration, where one Chris Harrington, who used to co-host WrestleNomics Radio, who now works for AEW, did disclose under penalty of perjury, he swore that between September 1st, 2022 and the present, which is, this is being filed in October 2024, so that's a 26-month period, he said that AEW competitive class members, which is AEW wrestlers, I take it, they made more than $60 million in aggregate. So that's just over a two-year period. AEW wrestlers made $60 million. So something probably more than $30 million a year at this point. Figure salaries are going up on an annual basis. And you just put that in some perspective here. In over a similar period, a slightly shorter period of time, 24 months, the top four TKO executives alone made more money than all of AEW talent, according to that sworn declaration, because we do have, via TKO's SEC filings, their own self-disclosures, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and our friend Mark Shapiro, who's about to go ahead, speaking of people going head-to-head, Mark Shapiro is going to appear in minutes at the, don't tune out, is going to appear in minutes at the Goldman Sachs conference. Mark Shapiro.
I like the sound of that.
Right. He made $32 million over that two-year period. So $68 million. This is just Mark Shapiro, Ari Emanuel, the chief legal officer, Seth Krauss, and the CFO, Andrew Schleimer. Most people listening probably don't even know who those last two people are. And this is not even getting into Nick Khan or Paul Levesque. They're not part of the proxy statement anymore because this is a combined company. But just to put that in some perspective, like the entire AEW roster over this two-year period making less than just four guys who are the leaders of TKO. So to fact check Danielson's claim that 40%. So let's say it's something just over 30. I estimated for 2024, AEW generated a revenue of $168 million. So about 30 divided by 168 is 18%. So that's a far cry from 40%. It's probably higher than WWE's percentage. But it's still relatively low if they had collective bargaining, which is not foreseeable, but you know, it's professional wrestling. And if you can, you know, if you can be a TKO executive and make vastly more money than the talent, that's your right, I guess.
Yeah. And I mean, this is something that we have seen, at least on the MMA side. Like typically the competitor is going to have to pay above market value in order to secure like those talents that would become available from the industry leader. And this is why, you know, Strikeforce, for instance, had to pay competitively to retain fighters. And you saw when fighters from Strikeforce, when the UFC ended up purchasing Strikeforce, a lot of these fighters on Strikeforce deals, they had these great contracts coming over to the UFC that had to be honored. And conversely, like if a Bellator, when it was in existence, if a fighter came up for free agency, you know, they would have to, you know, present such an offer because you are leaving the top industry promotion in order to go for a competitor. It's just, it is natural that the number two is going to have to pay to acquire that. And, you know, we're in such an, like industry now where it's like this label that has been placed on AEW, just throwing out this money at talent. And it's only because like the amount that is kind of accepted was so below market value. And we're looking at AEW that even if that checks out at 18%, would still be well below market value. Like, I think we can look at generally, are professional wrestlers in both companies underpaid? In many cases, you could probably say yes for the amount of revenue that is coming in and what it's owed. If you're going to use professional sports that have representation as a comp, a lot of them are dramatically underpaid, but compared to the norms of the pro wrestling industry, this is this golden period in terms of talent that are making incredible amounts of money and working less dates than ever. There is not the marathon live event schedule that has to be maintained. People are having more of a balance at home. In AEW, you have a lot more of a road expenses and such being covered, but there's still, like, to me, significant inroads to be made for these talents and just becoming in the same kind of conversation as athletes that do have the benefit of representation and more rights when it comes to what is owed to them.
Well, it's just about leverage, right? It tells you that there's a lot of room still to bargain if they had the leverage. They didn't have the leverage that they have now until AEW came along, and AEW's given talent in both companies a lot of leverage. And you know, collectively bargaining would give them even more leverage. It tells you, especially given the profitability, right? The growing profitability of WWE and its great media deals that it's making is increasing its profitability. And we see that in adjusted EBITDA, and you know, they're making hundreds of millions of dollars in what they call adjusted EBITDA, which is their special profit metric. And I should correct myself because I think I misspoke just a minute ago. So TKO's top four executives made more than $60 million in this period. Just in 2024, they made $68 million between Mark Shapiro, Ari Emanuel, Seth Krause, and Andrew Schleimer. But over a 24-month period, which overlaps largely with this period that we have disclosed from AEW, they made $158 million.
That's almost
three times. I mean, Ari Emanuel alone, he got a lot of compensation because of the closure of the TKO merger. But Ari Emanuel alone made $83 million in this period. Ari Emanuel, one person, made $83 million in this two-year period where, you know, AEW claims $60 million was made in a slightly longer period for all of their talent. So just to put that in some perspective. Given how high the top executive compensation is, given how strong profitability is in WWE and will continue to be, there's a lot of room if you get together and bargain for it. But that's going to take people on top like Cody and Roman Reigns and Bryan Danielson and CM Punk and the MJFs and all those people to take that risk with you. And as long as those people continue to be well taken care of, you know, they have the least to gain and the most to risk. So the incentives aren't there.
Yeah, like it's an interesting thought exercise, and I understand this sounds completely ludicrous to even throw out, but if you had any kind of just of the WWE talent having some kind of interest that is all aligned among the talent that have some level of representation when it comes to WWE practices and such, like what is the talent's argument to go forward with a competitive practice that is designed to undercut a competitor? Like if I was in that locker room, it's like, it stands, there is no gain for me to participate in this, in like this head to head deal with, if your ultimate goal is to at minimum handicap AEW when it comes to its next round of negotiation, like in what world does that enhance my marketability, enhance my leverage, and secure me a 15% increase during my next contract cycle? Like all of these things run counter to your objectives as a performer. And yet there would probably be at most a fleeting thought among talent towards that. And this is just another show. And this is what we do. We run head to head competition. And this is what we do. It's company versus company, but you stand nothing to gain by being on the winning side of that argument.
It would be one thing if WWE was doing, let's say, and I'm not saying that I know that they're doing this, right? But we know of one case where they're doing this. Let's say they're making exclusive deals with venues to keep AEW out of venues, although practically speaking, they're not running similar size venues. But say they were doing, just things on the management side to try to undermine AEW. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. That's one thing. But clearly, I think their biggest motivation in competing strongly is that their expenses have grown when it comes to talent. And you know, just repeating what we've already said, but you're being asked on nights like Saturday Night's Main Event going head-to-head with AEW and WrestlePalooza going head-to-head with All Out, you're being asked to carry out a task that undermines your, that has a goal to undermine your economic interests. But I don't think those wrestlers are even aware of that, though.
Yeah, it just goes to show you as well. Just yes, talent expenses have increased year over year. But to the other side of that column, sponsorship revenue has jumped that much more. Say nothing of either new rights agreements or rights renewals that more than compensate for this. But the argument is that, well, we can increase those columns, but we can't let this one decrease either. Everything needs to grow and grow and grow. And that's going to be the mindset. And that is what those that have no care about this will just simply look at like that. And quite frankly, that is the WWE's and TKO's objective. Like this is not something where talent can just sit and complain about this. There needs to be movement on behalf of the talent because there is no incentive structure for WWE to change this mindset because it is a value to them. The question is, what is a value to you as a performer? And that's a much more complicated issue because this is not an industry that is built on kind of collective thinking, collective organization. It is very individualized and you're simply looking at not rocking the boat or, listen, I'm making more money than ever before. There's no problem with this structure, and I'm not worrying about an industry that loses a competitor because that's too far off of a notion that is not of the immediate concern.
It's what it is. I mean, it's an eat what you kill world.
Thank you, Mark. Couldn't have said it better.
And I was just like, if you're somebody in Mark Shapiro's role, you have an obligation to the people, to the shareholders who are giving you their money to get them a strong return. And if you neglect to do so, they might sue you. That happens all the time.
Legendary doesn't happen by chance. It happens because it's what BetMGM does. Sign up for BetMGM and check out all the exciting new ways you can make this pro football season unforgettable. Shoot your shot with same-game parlays. Call your plays like a pro with live betting. Or bet on a market you didn't know existed thanks to BetMGM Originals. You'll be on the edge of your seat from the very first snap, no matter what type of fan you are. Earn BetMGM rewards points on every bet. Take advantage of football offers found nowhere else, like a second chance on a first touchdown bet. And keep an eye out for rewards dropping in your account throughout the season. Never settle for the ordinary. Sign up today. BetMGM. Make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. Specific promotional offers are not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text OPENY 467-369. For Arizona, 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood. Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC, member SIPC, a registered broker-dealer.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2 times the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Well, that segues over to Who's Suing Who, a recurring segment on this show. And last week we talked about Nick Bollea and Terry McCoy, who are suing Bubba the Love Sponge, real name Bubba the Love Sponge, over the
All Rights Reserved. That's really in the filing.
The artist formerly known as Todd Clem, for the upcoming release of Video Killed the Radio Star, the documentary detailing the Hulk Hogan sex tape and Bubba the Love Sponge's role slash lack of role in the recording and dissemination of said sex tape back in 2012. So after we spoke last Wednesday, the next day, a judge did grant a temporary restraining order, and this was in advance of Friday's screening in Tampa, where they ended up getting served at the venue. And it was at the venue that they got served. They had to make an 8-second edit out of the 190-minute documentary. And they are stating that those 8 seconds will be restored in the release that is coming up this Friday, for those that want to see the documentary itself. But we did get a response from Bubba the Love Sponge's team on Tuesday.
So if I can set the table, like, what is happening here? Because I think you know parts of this that I don't, maybe. So Bubba the Love Sponge is involved with this documentary. As he's going to discuss in his response, which he's already filed, he's not actually the producer or the distributor. That's somebody else. That's a production company.
Films are the producers.
And so Nick Bollea and this financial advisor, Terry McCoy, what they're taking issue with is that the sex tape appears, at least in the trailer. So it's in the trailer, presumably it's going to be in the documentary. And that sex tape is a copyrighted work that belongs to the estate of Terry Bollea. So what the judge ruled is that he ruled that you do get a restraining order when it comes to the sex tape material. So what you're talking about, that edit that they made, he didn't put a stop on the release of the documentary.
No.
That's why they were able to screen the documentary on Friday night. But he did rule that you have to take that material out of the documentary.
Which sounds like it sounds minor, but like if they got served like a couple hours before this screening, having to edit 8 seconds out.
And you can't see this documentary for yourself. Only the people who were there at the special screening, which by the way, I guess Brooke Hogan was there. You can't buy this yet. It comes out on the 12th, I think.
Friday.
I hate that we're by de facto like promoting this. But so it's not stopping the release of the documentary, is my understanding.
Correct. They're still moving forward with the release of this documentary, and they are promoting the fact that it will be unedited. The 8 seconds that Nick Bollea doesn't want you to see.
This 3-hour and 10-minute documentary, yeah.
Like, I'm sorry. I haven't seen this documentary, obviously. I was not. I thought about flying down on Friday to Tampa, but I thought against it.
Are you going to be reviewing this documentary for Post Wrestling?
If this thing was like 100 minutes, maybe. 3 hours? Are you kidding me?
I don't know if I talk about the content. Can we spoil this documentary for the listeners?
Okay. Hulk Hogan spoiler with warning. Clem. That's the spoiler.
I'm going to read this from the Tampa Bay Times, though, which is, you know, from a reporter who did go to the screening.
Yes.
Near the end, with help from, you know, now warning, spoiler alert. Close your ears if you don't want to hear the
spoilers. God, imagine someone saying you ruined the Bubba the Love Sponge Hulk Hogan sex tape documentary for me.
This is according to the Tampa Bay Times. Near the end, with help from Roger Stone, the film tries to draw... I noticed 3 hours have gone by.
Sorry, yeah, Roger Stone makes his way into this documentary. Are we really promoting this, or are we giving you the ultimate warning in advance? Okay, true or it's false that Donald Trump holding his fist up after the assassination attempt, that image makes its way into the documentary, drawing a parallel between Bubba the Love Sponge and... an assassination attempt on...
For those who don't know, Roger Stone is a prominent consultant and lobbyist associated with Donald Trump. And I just want to read what this says. The film tries to draw a line between Clem, the sex tape, and the prosecution of President Donald Trump's former attorney, Michael Cohen, and Trump's own conviction of 34 felonies, plus cancel culture, and the supposed crumbling of journalistic standards. So they're gonna fix our job, too.
If there's anything I would rather watch, it's Bubba the Love Sponge lamenting cancel culture. So the claim from Bubba the Love Sponge's team is they want this. First of all, they want the temporary restraining order to be dissolved, calling it constitutionally unsustainable. And they're making two prominent claims. One is that no estate for Terry Bollea has been opened and no personal rep has been appointed. Therefore, Nick and Terry McCoy lack the authority to seek this injunctive relief. Now, Us Weekly has just posted a story today, I believe, with details of Terry Bollea's will and Brooke Hogan not being privy to any inheritance, but also in that piece noting that yesterday, Tuesday, Nick Bollea and Terry McCoy started the process of becoming the representations for Hulk Hogan's estate. So we're trying to keep this all pieced together, but
and Bubba is basically saying, why are you suing me? I'm not the person who owns the documentary. He apparently is the major subject of the documentary, but he's not the production company, which I'll find.
Which I think is like the more substantial
Waltz Films.
Yeah. They're arguing here that the documentary, it's owned, controlled, produced and distributed by Waltz Films. Clem has no creative control, no ownership, no distribution rights, no exhibition rights. All he did was take part in the documentary, and he did sign a content license agreement with the producers to promote the film on his platforms. And even if that was the case, that he was involved in any of that, this would be within fair use for copyright purposes. But the fact that Waltz Films is not even a defendant in this case, I think this is a very substantial defense on behalf of Bubba the Love Sponge here, in that, like, again, he is not the one producing this documentary. So at the very least, like, Waltz Films should be a co-defendant in all of this, because they are controlling the marketing of the film and what goes in the documentary, what would come out of the documentary. And Clem
and
is basically...
regarding the copyrighted work, the sex tape, he's saying that all that's in the documentary are things that are public already. He's saying, I don't have the tape. I don't have it. I don't have it to send to anybody. So he's saying that there's no portion of the sex tape, which is their copyrighted property, that's in this beyond, you know, surface level clips that are already readily available in the public.
He also, Clem also defends the comments he has made on his radio show, that the plaintiffs cannot establish irreparable harm because Clem's comments, first of all, in the documentary film, reflect Bollea in a positive or neutral light. And when it comes to exploiting Bollea's declining health, Clem's statements were truthful and newsworthy. And the documentary is a journalistic and historical work. That's what I want. That should be Video Killed the Radio Star, The Bubble of the Love Sponge Story, a historical work. I mean, yep. if anything, I mean, Hulk Hogan has been involved in many historical works that have been presented in the public. So
he's done many, many works in history. That's true.
That's right. Anyway, the trailer and documentary do not exhibit the sex tape itself. Rather, it uses news clips from publicly available sources and have been disseminated and already exist in the public domain. Clem's radio career and why Clem's radio career had been altered, which sounds like that's the main focus of this documentary, is kind of absolving Todd Clem and how his career was affected by this sex tape and the accusations that he admits to recording it, but not to distributing it and getting it out in the public, which
a question I would have, especially if I were the plaintiffs here, is, okay, maybe you don't own this film, but given how hard he's promoting it, he's clearly incentivized in some form. I don't know what his agreement is. I would be surprised if he is not, you know, getting royalties, or, you know, if he's not going to benefit proportionate to the success of this film.
Yeah, I mean, he says he has no ownership or distribution, but you're right. Like, you could, it certainly does not say that there is no incentive structure in place. Like, you sell X amount of units and you're going to get this percentage of the profits. There's certainly that argument. I'm not even dismissing the fact that he shouldn't be a defendant in this case, but like, Waltz Films, to me, like, they are the ones that are distributing the documentary itself.
And Nick and Terry McCoy are alleging that Bubba broke a settlement agreement, which may be some sort of NDA. We don't know, because all this stuff is sealed. And it's sealed for now. The judge just ordered, just before we came to air here, that their settlement agreement is temporarily sealed, but they both have to make an argument about why keeping it sealed is more important than disclosing it in the public interest. So they have to make an argument about why it's an argument that their confidentiality is more important than the public interest in this case. So that contract may end up being unsealed. We'll see.
Yeah. So they're asking for the temporary restraining order to be dissolved, and they're looking for a preliminary injunction. And as well, if the temporary restraining order is not dissolved, to expedite a hearing, because the release is coming up in 2 days as well, and then seeking relevant court costs and attorney fees.
So since we've been on the air, it looks like the judge has ruled that there will be a hearing on Wednesday the 17th. So that's after the film will be released, I guess, right?
Yes. So there you go.
Live up to the minute coverage. Does this mean ridiculous?
Are we going to have to program around this hearing next week? I mean, maybe Bubba the Love Sponge gets distribution rights to this trial hearing, and we can we could just like air it right here live. We could do commentary.
No, you can do that. Maybe
that's where Brandon puts his foot down. Okay, moving on. John Cena. They have promoted all of his final dates. They have not officially announced the retirement show, but Russell Vogt's reporting that it will take place in Washington, D.C. on December 13th. This will be a Saturday night's main event, which
I've also heard that Washington, D.C. is the location.
Yep. Yes. Which we, you know, it had been speculated upon. Was this John Cena retirement going to be moved to go against World's End? I mean, I'm sure maybe they just want to wait till after Christmas to do this, this big send off, but it will be December 13th exclusively on Peacock. And, Dave Meltzer had reported that this had to do with wanting like a site fee out of Boston. I have not confirmed that, but Boston
multiple records requests were sent to certain organizations in Boston. They were not fruitful, though.
Well, instead, Boston will get one of Cena's last Raw appearances. They've announced Raw November 10th in Boston at the TD Garden, November 17th at Madison Square Garden, which is always a very costly venue for them to run. So he's going to be doing he's on Raw this coming Monday in Springfield, WrestlePalooza, Crown Jewel in Australia, October the 11th, the Boston and New York Raws in November, the Survivor Series in San Diego at the end of November, and then the Saturday night's main event. So that is seven more appearances that he has scheduled.
Is that it then? He's going to be wrestling on all of those. Probably not, right?
Probably not wrestling on all of these, but at least, you know, doing
Who's the last match going to be with? Randy Orton, one more for the road.
We could do, Wei threw out the idea of doing like another match with Brock. I think Gunther is an opponent you could throw out there.
Reigns?
I guess Reigns would be kind of the last big name that he hasn't worked during this final run.
He's already done Cody twice, so I mean, Roman Reigns.
Rollins is out there now as well as, now that he's back as Cena's back as a babyface. Like those would kind of be the candidates that you would look at. I guess I'm curious as well, like what the Peacock effect is going to be. Like that is certainly going to be the biggest Peacock only stream that they're going to have with something the level of Cena's retirement of, like, what is going to be the effect of losing NBC and having a big attraction like Cena's last match, because it's going to be very hard to replicate something as big as Cena's retirement for any of these subsequent Peacock only shows.
If only Nielsen would tell us what the viewership will be. We'll never know, I guess.
Maybe by the end of December, maybe they're looking at this a little further. Canelo Alvarez and Terrence Crawford, this is Zuffa Boxing's big jump into the boxing arena as they will be hosting this card on Saturday night from Allegiant Stadium, which they have been promoting the hell out of on WWE programming for months. There's a two-part countdown series on Netflix now, and I think this is going to be a really big fight. I don't think this is going to approach the levels that Mike Tyson and Jake Paul generated last November, but I think it's going to be pretty damn high. I think that Canelo fighting, and it's not on pay-per-view, it's a really big fight for them to put on, and it would seem that like this is going to be a pretty big event this coming weekend. And what it pertains to, you know, Zuffa Boxing's future and what it's going to line up for some of its biggest fights.
This is in Las Vegas. This is in Allegiant Stadium, correct?
Yes.
So we'll get some attendance information from the Stadium Authority. And you know what other logo I do see here? Not just Riyadh season, but I do see a Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority logo here. So maybe some site fee information, but it's going to take some work to get some information out of our.
You don't think they'll be forthcoming with information for you?
So far, they have not been. But, proceedings are continuing to proceed.
Brandon has filed a petition against said authority for them to.
He's got some litigation that he's working through.
Perfectly said. Now, WWE is semi-piggybacking off of this with the World Collide show the night before on Friday. This will be at 10 Eastern, immediately after SmackDown's in Virginia, and then World's Collide begins right afterwards on YouTube from the Cox Pavilion, which is like a 3,000-seater. The last update we had from WrestleTix as of a couple days ago was that they've moved about 2,000 tickets, and I thought this would just be a given, that this would be a great crossover. Like, you'd have a lucha event the night before in Vegas for a Canelo fight. But I don't know. This event feels to me like it has by far the least amount of buzz of any of these WWE-promoted AAA events. It just seems like it's a show. They booked a really small venue, and as of right now, they have not filled this very small venue. I'm sure they will fill it. It's 3,000 people, roughly, that they can fit in this thing. But I would not say this has been, from at least a live attendance perspective, like it's this great add-on for WWE to piggyback.
Yeah, this isn't like the equivalent of the Hulu Theater at the MSG. It's this Tonic and Mac Pavilion.
Yeah, yeah. This was, I mean, TNA's run in this building. UFC's done a lot of shows at this was, I guess, formerly the Cox Pavilion. That might even still be what it's referred to as here.
2,066 is the last count from WrestleTix.
2,066. Yep. So anyway, that's going down on Friday, and it's just more so interesting. I'd be curious, like, you can see if you look at the lineup for this card, like, it's all, they're still using like AAA talent, but it is more and more WWE heavy. It's all kind of interpromotional, and you just wonder, like, if they're just going to get down to like a core group representing AAA, and like how much of that is going to be appealing, that this just becomes another WWE event that is more akin to an NXT premium live event versus something unique and distinct that's going to grab interest from your regular viewers. And we saw, you know, they did a tremendous attendance for the show in LA back in June, Triple Mania seemed like Triple Mania is Triple Mania. It's still like a big deal. But this one to me is the most glaring of just a show.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the power of it. Is it's an NXT level event that they can do once in a while. I think there's peak interest for the first one that they did in LA, right, where they did over 10,000, I think, in Kia Forum. And I think it's going to be, you know, what can an NXT PLE do? Probably this.
It's kind of about at that level. I would say like 2,000 is low, but booking like these sized venues is probably the extent of what they're looking for. And I mean, ultimately, this is a play for a broadcast agreement in the U.S. And I think that's going to be the success or failure of this purchase of AAA.
And while we're at it, you didn't mention WrestleTix for Canelo Crawford yet, right? 64,577 as of, I think this is 2 days ago. This is about 3 days ago that WrestleTix put this estimate out. Over 64,000 out at Legion Stadium.
That's right. So on that note, Paul Levesque was promoting many, many things on the Pat McAfee show. I think this was yesterday.
Yes.
And including the fact that he's going to be on Kill Tony next Monday. Can't wait. Exciting stuff on Netflix. He also spoiled that Cody Rhodes will be at WrestlePalooza, just ruining that return. And also, Pat McAfee tap dancing ever so delicately around the WWE's relationship with Saudi Arabia and what WWE has done for the country.
WWE has been a massive piece of kind of transforming a country, I think, as a whole. Yeah. Your relationship with them has been cool to watch. Now, at the beginning of that, that's another thing, a lot of shots to the shins. Oh, you're going to work with, you know, and then obviously everything that's ever happened in Saudi Arabia gets listed off in the article. Like, this is the same country that blah, 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 blah. But I think the WWE's mindset from the people that I talk to that are actually in the room, yourself included, it's like, well, how are they ever going to, if we don't, and it's like WWE, the first time, I don't think there was a lot of women on the card. Then the next time that, I don't think women were allowed to wrestle or anything like that in the way they had to dress. Then you had a women's main event with a woman ref, I think, at one point over there. And it's like the way they've kind of evolved as a country through the relationship with WWE. I'm not saying WWE directly only involved, because I think the Crown Prince, God bless him, has been a massive piece of that in Turkey as well.
Yeah.
But it has been an evolution.
But that's been their goal since the beginning, I think, is to change their perception, to change how they are, to, you know, open up that umbrella for women and with the country. But it takes time. You can't just do that stuff all at once, right? You alienate all the people that are in front of it that had an old long-standing belief. So you've got to do it over time. And I truly believe that to initiate change, you got to be a part of it. You can't just sit back on the sidelines, say we're not going to participate, that and these people don't do things the right way. You need to be there and be part of that change. And we've been part of that change since the beginning, proudly been a part of that change.
Boom. Problem
solved. Part of the change. That's why, I mean, it's really unfair when people go after WWE for, they're just helping, a country be more progressive.
You always want to be setting records, right? Like, that is the goal that you get into business for. And according to Amnesty International, Saudi Arabian officials carried out a record number of executions for a wide range of crimes and in circumstances that violated international law and standards. So that is...
You're just kicking them in the shins right now.
Kicking them in the shins, yeah. I did enjoy, like,
Why don't you talk about you when WWE runs in the United States almost every week? Why don't you talk about all the terrible things that the United States is doing?
All I will say about this, I'm not even at a place right now where it's just like anger, okay, or anything. But if you're going to tout all of this, like, let's just be honest about the fact and include, hey, we're making a ton of money going here. Like, that is our sole reason for going here.
Just from ticket sales, right? Because there's a lot of fans in Saudi Arabia.
$50 million per show, give or take, probably probably a conservative figure for what they will get for the Royal Rumble next January. But let's just be honest. But
how do we know
this?
That? And is how does that compare to like a normal WWE show, though? Don't they make $50 million like every show?
No, Brandon, because this chart tells me that by running in Saudi Arabia since 2018, they have raked in more than every WrestleMania combined, Brandon.
What's the biggest single day pro wrestling gate ever? Probably either of the two, probably the second WrestleMania Sunday this year, which, I don't know, let's take a guess, 25 million, because we know the record before that is somewhere like 19, so presumably they broke it this year. So let's say it's 25 million. That's maybe a little generous, but let's say it's about 25 million. They're doing double that every time they go to Saudi Arabia. But is it their fault that people are just spending $50 million in ticket sales every time they go?
This being WWE?
They're selling $50 million of tickets every time they go to Saudi Arabia, right? Right?
No.
Oh.
That is not the case.
Who's giving them $50 million then?
I heard a rumor that it is the government that is fronting that amount of money per show.
The government is giving them that money, regardless of how many people go to the show?
Regardless. Even if they come with couches or not, $50 million.
Okay. So I guess that is different than a standard WWE show anywhere else in the world?
Well, until the UFC goes to the White House next year on the taxpayer's dime.
That would be
dime,
the analogy.
TKO is not receiving any direct funding from the government to stage shows to
site fees.
There are site fees, but that is not from the federal government. That would be from various states that are bringing in WWE for tourism purposes.
And it's a lot less money, even though it is millions.
But let's, like, I'm just going to put everything on the table here. It's like, listen, it's wonderful if you want to have that view of what these shows are, but let's not be so altruistic to state that if this deal did not exist, they would not be going to Saudi Arabia. They would not be concerned about change in this country. They would not be speaking about all the virtues of going to Saudi Arabia. It is completely contingent on a record-setting deal that went into effect in 2018. And if it was removed at the end of this 10-year deal, they would not be going there, just like they aren't going to other places in the Middle East, because they are not paying them to come. And in Paul Levesque's own words, to help their image, which WWE has been more than happy to assist with, but at a record profitable rate for the company. And that's it. Like, this is a transaction. So we don't have to bury our head in the sand about any other reasons beyond exactly what you're seeing on this chart right here. And the idea that this has changed the country, you can look at whatever your relationship is to human rights records of where a company goes. That's to your discretion as a consumer, whether that plays any factor or not. You may just watch these shows like any other shows, but these are facts that are still persistent and worth acknowledging, like what this is versus what it isn't.
It would be one thing if they were really just, you know, selling tickets to the consumers, to the fans in Saudi Arabia, but this is a government transaction, and it's really unlike anything in pro wrestling history, except for maybe Collision in Korea, where a wrestling company got an extremely high amount of money from a government to do some, you know, and to do exactly what these shows succeed at doing, which is broadcast an event to the rest of the world to show that, you know, maybe we want to take a trip there. Maybe, you know, Saudi Arabia is a place that I am familiar with and that I don't have bad feelings about. It's remaking their image and showing that, oh, this is, I mean, look at all the great work that Turkey's doing. And look at the MMA fights and the boxing fights that are happening here. Watch these shows. These are spectacular events. This seems like a normal country. And lots of countries do lots of bad things. But not every country pays WWE $50 million. To help normalize that. And that's what this relationship is. And they don't just pay him $50 million once. They pay him $50 million 20 times, which equals $1 billion over 10 years.
And I think if you were to exclude the first two shows under this deal, like the first one, the Greatest Royal Rumble, I mean, you watch that show. I mean, it is like you could go into that show without any kind of thought towards what this deal is supposed to be and come out of it with just a horrible taste in your mouth of like what of how it was sold to you, literally doing an angle based off of a a proxy war involving your representatives of Iran coming out to confront the Saudi Arabian wrestlers. And then the second show, which came a month after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Like, those were the two that I think really did light that underneath the wrestling audience of looking at this. Because you take those two shows out, I don't know if there's a fraction of the resistance to these shows that those two kind of set the standard for.
In the first show, remember, it had the most overt government propaganda. There was literally a video package that was played to promote how great of a job Mohammed bin Salman is doing and how he's a progressive leader that's allowing women to drive.
And came shortly after, like, he had done that big tour of the U.S. and he had done, you know, he was on the cover of like Time magazine, and he was sort of the front facing figure of the country, of a new Saudi Arabia. And it really was not until the Khashoggi murder that really soured on a worldwide level.
Including, and there was Ari Emanuel,
I mean, of who today, or at least when he did that interview with Freakonomics, has no idea why he ended up returning all that money. But at the time he did, and needed personal protection because he was in fear of what the repercussions of walking back that deal were going to have on him personally. And
I, like, think I know why he changed his mind.
Well, I mean, we can't speculate, right? I mean, maybe he just woke up one day and forgot. But,
well, he merged UFC with WWE, and WWE has a really lucrative relationship with this government. And it's a few years ago now, so all right.
Well, there's Paul Levesque. Don't kick them in the shins over.
Did they really do a women's main event? Is he using main event loosely there?
I think he was trying to say, like, there was a female referee. I don't know if there was a main event. They've definitely had female refs on the show. I mean, There are plenty of female performers. I mean, next year, in theory, there's going to be a whole Women's Royal Rumble on the show. So, I mean, like, that is certainly something that was not there at the beginning. But, I mean, you can assess for yourself. Like, I think it's one thing if you are just viewing this in the prism of, like, what progress has been made in the context of a WWE versus the country at large. And, you know, there are people that maybe will argue that, you know, there are shifts to the country, but I mean, do your own, like, research into, like, what the human rights records are and the executions that have occurred for things as minor as people with minimal follower counts tweeting about the government and what freedoms you have.
Right. Just days before, I think something like 2 weeks before the last WWE show in Saudi Arabia, a journalist, Turki Al-Jasser, who was in jail for years, essentially for tweeting about how the government was corrupt, allegedly, according to him, he was executed. And this is not, like, reportedly. This is according to the government's own announcement.
Final topics before we wrap things up here. We go back to Raw from a week ago, September 1st, they did 2.4 million views, 5.2 million hours viewed. They ranked 8th globally, 5th in the U.S., 9th in Canada. They were only in the top 10 in 6 countries, but this was the live show that aired from Paris. So it aired at 2 p.m. Eastern in the afternoon as opposed to in prime time. And this comes before an experiment that they're doing over the next 3 weeks, where Raw is going to air at 7 p.m. Eastern time to get a jump on Monday Night Football over the next 3 Mondays as well. But this was, I believe this was their lowest in terms of global views launching in January.
This is the lowest global views number ever. Not the lowest in terms of hours viewed, but is the lowest in terms of global views. So if they're manipulating the numbers, they're not manipulating them hard enough, or they're so bad that they're afraid to manipulate more. The fact that that they're playing with the time, I think, is suggestive that they're at least not super confident in this number, in the numbers that they're delivering.
Yeah. How long was this one listed for? It was
126 minutes is the final cut, just over 2 hours.
Okay. Yeah, because that show, God, I feel like that show went above the usual 2.5 hour mark. I would have to double check, but
yeah, I mean, that this is a longer show than in a while.
Yeah,
right. This is the longest runtime since back here in April post WrestleMania. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. And then the collision number on Saturday, again, another one coming off an all-time low in its regular time slot, did 300,000 viewers and a 0.07. So this was their largest number since August 9th. They significantly increased their female audience across all demos. Were 16th on cable because they were going against like 100 college football games, Major League Baseball as well. I mean, this is just going to be the slate of competition that they're going to have on Saturday nights. And yeah, I guess, you know, in this era, this is considered like a good collision number doing a 0.07.
Yeah, I mean, how is this holding up compared to the rest of what's on the network? The yellow dots here are collision, and most of the time it's higher than the other original programs, at least that are on TNT.
And some super chats here. So we go to Jumanji Hunter. How would you evaluate the Netflix move so far?
I think that they're going to play with the time. I mean, it could just be nothing. It could be nothing that, oh, well, you know, we've got complete freedom with the time slot here because it's Netflix. It's not bound to linear television's traditional time slots. But if this was a roaring success, you wouldn't play with the time slot. So it at least removes that conclusion to me that they're super happy with it. Now they might be okay with it. They might be decently happy with it, but they're not super over the hill thrilled.
If it was a smashing success, like how much more aggressive would they have gone after the PLE rights as compared to ESPN? I think that's an interesting one of like a...
And Shapiro did say that they got a bid that was larger in monetary value than ESPN's bid, but they wanted to be on many partners. So that could have been Netflix, I guess is what I'm saying. We don't know, but not strong enough to persuade.
Yeah, and it does make you wonder, like, of having, like, weekly programming versus your one big monthly event of what fits a Netflix model versus an ESPN model. And the idea of, you know, Netflix, like, they constantly are looking for big style events. And this is kind of a departure from that, where it is, like, weekly sports adjacent programming on their streaming service as well, as opposed to having the big event that ESPN is going to have in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Another one here is from Andrew McDonald. Do you think that TNA and ROH would have been stronger competitors if their billionaire investors, the Carters and Sinclair, invested the money in their companies like Tony Khan did?
Money always helps.
Money always helps. I don't know if Bob Carter was a billionaire, but let's, for the sake of this argument, just
let's say they put a lot more money.
They had a ton of money. I mean, first of all, like TNA, they absorbed a lot of losses over the years, and then they got, you know, according to Jeff Jarrett, they reached like profitability once they were into that kind of like 2-hour weekly primetime slot with Spike TV, and that was kind of the golden period for TNA until they lost Spike in 2014. I don't look at TNA necessarily as just something that failed because of a lack of investment, because God, what name did they not bring in during that period? Like they brought in a ton of talent. It was ultimately something that they got, you know, good television viewership weekly, but it was a struggle to get people to buy pay-per-views, to go to house shows. And it was just a product that, despite a period when, you know, AEW would prove like there could be an opening there because of WWE not servicing its fan base, TNA was not, you know, for the most part, filling a need in the marketplace that enough fans were willing to spend money on their product. But I don't look at it necessarily as TNA just did not, like, they competed for, it just seemed like every talent that came available, they tried to bring in at some point or another. And outside of your biggest names in WWE, most of them came through the doors at TNA at some point or another. And they also had a hold on that whole kind of era of ROH performers and talent that WWE was not interested in for a long period of time until Paul Levesque remade NXT.
Yeah, I would say that for TNA, it depends on the timing. But I think regardless, you know, TNA eventually scorched its brand so badly that after a certain point, there wasn't hope, I think, after into the 2010s or so. Now, even if they had a lot of money, or even if they had a lot of money allocated to them, like AEW has, right? They also have what AEW would have, presumably, in terms of sufficient TV relationships. I mean, TNA was able to make a deal with Spike. Ring of Honor is itself at least a syndicator. But what I think, and let's say they all have this, have reasonable enough access to talent, I think what they wouldn't have that is different from what Tony Khan had is, for one thing, in Ring of Honor, the timing could have worked for them in, say, the mid-2010s, where you've, or late 2010s. I think really, you know, Tony Khan's taking of an opportunity was kind of taking it from Ring of Honor that apparently wasn't ambitious to do it, right? Like, there's no reason why it had to be a newcomer, right? Mm-hmm. But what I think is very different in AEW's case versus any point in TNA's history or Ring of Honor's history is, at least the Sinclair era, is that they didn't have somebody who, first of all, they didn't have the brand damage opportunity that WWE created by creating a hunger for an alternative. Now, that's timing, and I think Ring of Honor was there by the time that had really significantly happened. TNA had scorched its own brand. But they also, I don't think, had a leader who had a creative vision that suited that opportunity, which Tony Khan, for his the things that we criticize him for, he did and does have, right? I don't know that TNA had somebody who was going to understand how to create a product that would really connect with that fan who was really frustrated with Vince McMahon's product. I don't see where TNA would have that, or where late stage Ring of Honor would have that.
Yeah, I think Ring of Honor is like your more interesting test case of this question of like if by, you know, by 2017, 2018, I think those were years that ROH really was doing like meaningful business as a, you know, a small competitor to WWE, and more so it did have the nucleus of something. And when you had all those deals coming up at the end of 2018, that's what was the building block of AEW. And like ROH had an opportunity that they could have, you know, put in a ton of investment to kind of grow this thing and retain talent. And, you know, it kind of fell by the wayside, and it looked like it was going to, you know, at least be in the mix up until the pandemic. And the pandemic was really a killer for ROH. But I think in many ways, the die had been already cast at that point when AEW got up and running, and it sort of became a realized version of what was growing in ROH. But it did take AEW to take a lot of those talents and have that vision, and also have the ability to get onto a major network, which ROH had, you know, a syndication package, but it did not have that level of television presence.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you for the questions, everybody. Didn't get to these other stories, but John Nash did do a great write-up on The Uncrowned about the UFC fighters that are all receiving their payments now. It sounds like they got something like 99% of fighters did respond and get their claims for the $375 million settlement led by Anderson Silva, who's taking in more than $10 million from this settlement. It is not listed what Brock made, but it would be in the millions that he made for literally signing his name on, please pay to this account promptly. So there you have it. Others in this, you know, it is amazing that there were some fighters that rejected this money. They would not accept it.
I mean, they just love, I mean, I think that the TKO executives deserve even better pay. Maybe that can go towards their compensation.
Yes. And that is going to wrap up the show. We thank everyone for joining us, sending in your questions. We're here every Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern time. Next week, we will be, well, we will maybe be reacting to the big Bubba the Love Sponge v. Nick Bollea, Terry McCoy hearing. We've got the September 20th head-to-head battle going on. And remember, corporations are not people. That is the statement of the show this week. But Brandon, what is coming up in WrestleNomics, the WrestleNomics universe?
I will not be traveling to Florida next week to cover the hearing No? In federal court? No. It's federal court, so it won't be televised, unfortunately. There's reports, as always, data reports for every single episode of Raw, SmackDown, NXT, Collision, and Dynamite, with all of the information, not just TV ratings, but also attendance information, also YouTube information. All of that is there at patreon.com/WrestleNomics, as well as WrestleNomics.substack.com. I'm working through some records requests. We'll see if we learn anything. Perhaps about W or AEW business. So we will keep you updated.
He's knocking on doors, folks. And if you don't answer, get ready. Get ready for a petition. Over at postwrestling.com, I'm back tonight with Wei Ting. We will be live after Dynamite, the second to last show at the 2300 Arena for the group. And then Thursday at postwrestlingcafe.com, we are putting out our Ask Away mailbag show. We have a lot of questions to get through this month. I've looked at none of them, so we will see what questions you have for myself and Wei Ting. That is at postwrestlingcafe.com. Thanks everyone for joining us, and we'll speak with you next Wednesday. Enjoy. Video killed the radio star. Watch at your discretion.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow & Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten. Rakuten.com.